G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
It's a busy, busy morning after a busy, busy sporting weekend. Lots happening around the globe, let alone the local sporting front as well. Adam White, I'm sure, would have been dragged from pillar to post watching it all. Whitey, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Harf. And it is one of those weekends, one of the busiest I think we've had in sport this year. When you add the Premier League season starting over this weekend, the new season, the NFL season starting pretty much this morning. There's been one game late last week, but this is the first of the big Sunday weekends. So, all eyes on California a little bit later today with Cam Percy. You mentioned that he's the equal leader going into the final round. Because it's played in California, they're starting it a bit later. So he'll tee off, I reckon, about maybe in the next sort of half hour or so, but the coverage doesn't start until 8 o'clock. So we'll probably get the last sort of 12 holes of Cam. I reckon it's scheduled to finish about 11 o'clock this morning. So, amazing opportunity for him, because if he was to win, he gets to play in the Masters for the first ever time, apart from the $1 million, which would be handy as well. So we'll see how he goes.
I would take the million. I could use one of those at the moment, one of those $1 million things. I could use one of those. The Aussies in all sorts of trouble here in the cricket. Can't see that happening. But, 7 o'clock, I've just been informed off the interweb. Cam tees off for the last round.
So yeah, Alex Carey's still at the crease.
Yes, he is. Half.
Alex Carey is still at the crease. He's on strike, 25 off 10 balls with Rashid bowling. So it is unlikely, obviously, with only one wicket in hand and Hazelwood in. But, we know what Alex Carey is capable of, so I wouldn't quite rule them out yet.
Tell you what I want. I'll tell you who I would want at the crease in these sort of moments. I'd want Adam Ramanauskas. He's a Bombers champion these days, manager to the Stars. And what he does is finds a way to get stuff done. He eats pressure for breakfast, and he's back with us again on a Monday morning. And that's not out. Roma, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'd be a little bit nervous still at the crease. I like your comment. I like your comment, I'll take the $1 million, like it's an option for you, Harf. I don't think it's ever going to be an option in a tournament that you're going to be playing for $1 million.
Well, I didn't say tournament. I didn't say I had to be a sporting feat that gave me the million. I just would like that one of those $1 million they're handing out these days. I just want one.
Have you got any friends that are willing to do that for you? And that's the end of it. You've just been stumped.
Carey stumped, going for the big one. It's all over. England square the series 1-1.
I wouldn't have done that. I don't think it was Alex.
Well, you had to, Rem.
If I'm Alex Carey.
25 off 9. You needed to do that, Rem. You needed to do that. No. What was your weekend like, Rama?
It was sporty. It was very sporty, and as you guys both alluded to, there's plenty of sport going on. The NBA was one that we missed with the Lakers winning yesterday and going through to the Western Conference Finals, and the other final there with the Clippers and Denver now goes to a Game 7. Tomorrow, so I had my eye on that a little bit. I watched the tennis yesterday morning with Naomi Osaka winning, so that was a great match. What else was I watching on the weekend? Watched a bit of the golf, as Whitey said, a lot of football, which we'll touch on. So yeah, plenty of sport, which is nice. It's nice to be talking about sport.
Tell you what, the highlights of the weekend from an Australian sporting perspective, and probably a bit more close to home with us here at the Breakfast Club, is the news yesterday that after the last race in the F3 season at Mugello, we have a world champion, Oscar Piastri, who is our man. We claimed him early. We got on him at the start of the season in the F3, and now that young man is world champion. How good's that?
That's absolutely fantastic. You know what you would love with the F3 is if you win that, you then get you a ticket into obviously an F1 team. But unfortunately, it doesn't quite work like that. Obviously a team has to then sign you. But you wish that's how you could advance through those stages.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great effort. We obviously spoke to Oscar Would have been what, a couple of months ago?
I
think.
Yep.
A young fella from Melbourne, 19-year-old from Melbourne, who's travelling the globe to live his dream. And we talked about the challenges of getting a drive and the costs associated. We spoke to him in July, is the feedback we're getting, which is good news from Frank at the back. You know, putting all your eggs in the international sporting basket and trying to achieve your dream, it's fantastic. What a great performance. 19 years of age, becomes the F3 champion. Yeah, just a boy. Just a boy in a man's world, Renner. What a great opportunity.
Unbelievable. As we found at that age.
Yeah, as we found talking to Remy Gardner,
Came second
with Oscar.
On the weekend too, by the way. Remy came second.
Yeah, so there's Oscar and there's also Alex. The two sort of F3 drivers, yeah. And just the sacrifices that they've made, having to head overseas as young teenagers to sort of pursue their dreams, some with their parents, some without their parents. We certainly found out a lot about those three that are sort of the next wave of motor racing stars from an Australian perspective. But I was sort of, quite taken aback by the sacrifices that they've had to make to do it. And just how determined they are as such young men to do what they're doing. So, who knows what happens next with Oscar getting that victory.
Yeah, we're going to try and track him down tomorrow, hopefully. Next couple of days we'll track him down again and celebrate what's an outstanding achievement from Oscar. Alex, you mentioned there, finished 10th overall, I think, in the overall standings in the F3 this year. So, a good effort by another young Aussie going places in a hurry. But well done to Oscar, and we'll celebrate with him hopefully in the next couple of days. While we're talking motorsport, mentioned Remy Gardner's second place. He had pole position. Had a big dump on turn 11. He got dumped by the bike on turn 11 in the warm-up, I think, and then got back and finished second in the race. So that's a good effort by Remy going places as well. And in the F1s overnight at Mugello for the Tuscan GP, Dan Ricciardo finished in fourth position. We had a chance to take it a bit further. There was a bit of madness, a bit of chaos in that game, in that Grand Prix at Mugello. So it was nice to survive and get through himself, but finished fourth with Lewis Hamilton again taking out another GP. Just regular programming resumes in the F1. Just what he does, so he just wins.
Let's just go back to the cricket for the moment, just to give you a bit of context as to what happened last night. England won a really important toss in the second match, half and Rama. It was a wearing pitch. They'd played on it on the Friday, as you alluded to, before half, and it was very dry and a bit up and down, and I think anything over 250 was going to be a good score. England sort of, they were in trouble. They were 5 for 117, 6 for 140, 7 for 143, so really, in fact, you'd even say 8 for 149, that England were going to struggle to make anything more than 175. But, gee, they'd be kicking themselves, the Australians. Tom Curran made 37 and Adil Rashid made 35. So that saw them get to 231 off their 50 overs. So they really let them off the hook. Zampa bowled extremely well again. He took 3 for 36 and Hazelwood at the top, 1 for 27 off 10 to back up what he did on Friday night. So it was really going to be a difficult score for Australia to get 231 chasing on that pitch. Finch got off to a great start. He got 73. Labuschagne got 48. And we talked about Carey before. He was the last man out for 36. But quite a few failures, including Warner again at the top. And he was out to Archer once again. He was out for 6, caught behind. So the Australians, they'd be kicking themselves there, considering the position they got themselves in. Even to be 2 for 144 in the chase, to be all out for 207. So it's one all in the one-day series with one game to go.
You lost 7 for 33, which is a middle-order collapse, we'd like to call that, which they're prone to doing. The Aussies have been for many years. Yep. So that seemingly hasn't been rectified, that problem for the Australian batsmen.
No. Yeah.
But we know the England are pretty good too, just by the way.
Yeah, Stephen Smith didn't... Well, exactly right. They're the world champions. Stephen Smith didn't play again, so he missed that first game after being hit in the head in the nets, and they were overly cautious not playing him in the second because he was past fit to play, and they decided they'd wait another match, which, in a way, just gives an opportunity, again, for them to look at someone else. You know, Labuschagne in the team at the moment. He's new to the team. They played Stoinis at 3... So they're still just sort of trying to determine who their best team is, half.
Yep. Yeah, and that's okay. A bit of experimentation going on, Rimmer.
Well, is it? Yep. Is it in the Australian team? Like, I know what you're saying there, Whitey, but
they've been 6 months out of the game, all these people. And we've lost the World Cup.
All the more reason why you want to play. Cup.
Surely you want to try and get yourself in a position where the focus for the next window is to get a team together, assembled, to win the World Cup. Like, knocked out in the semis was a real blow, obviously, and surely your job as a one-day team is to build towards the next prime event. And the prime event in one-day cricket is the World Cup.
And I've always had a little bit of an issue with it. It's an Australian team. Pick the best Australian team that's available.
I don't know about
that. Well, I think in a way, Rama, they have. I mean, the only difference is that Smith isn't playing because he's out injured. So Stoinis gets an opportunity. He was past fit to play. But again, this is the way that Australians do it. They're overly cautious when it comes to head knocks. So
I reckon
this isn't
Steve
a situation
Smith in particular,
of him being rested.
You're going to have to look after, considering what's happened in England against Jofra Archer, the one of the bowlers bowling with a white ball, which comes at you harder for whatever reason. It's the right play. Nah. If he's not quite 100% right, or has any inkling that this isn't the moment for him, then keep him out. That's just good business.
So I know what you're saying, Rama, because over the last couple of years, well, in fact, it probably goes back 10 years, the Australians have never necessarily played their best team.
Correct.
But
it drives me
this
crazy.
This is their best team. If you take Stoinis out and put Smith in, I think that's what they think is their best team at the moment. I think there is only a spot for one of Stoinis or Marsh as the all rounder. I think Labuschagne has probably pushed his way into the best 11 now in one day cricket. Now England in the first match played their actual World Cup final 11. So they made a couple of changes in this team, and this was purely more a sort of a positional change because they wanted to play the spinner because of the pitch that I was talking about. So, I think both of these teams are pretty much full strength, which is what you want to see. Because it is, in a way, a bit of a meaningless one-day series, sort of, at the very end of the English summer, and Australia haven't played any cricket for a while. But, if they're going to play them, at least play their best team.
Which is what they did. Well, they did to a point. Now, what about the Channel 7 situation with the cricket, Whitey? What have you gleaned over that across the weekend?
Because this is very interesting.
That's a very, very complex and very angry conversation that's going on at the moment, it seems.
I think it's a lot more serious than what I first thought. I think that, it looks like 7 just want to dump the cricket because they've got some financial issues. That have intensified because of COVID. And, I think a new CEO is now in place. James Warburton wasn't in charge when Channel 7 got the cricket. So Tim Warner was. And James Warburton's of the belief, and probably others in there, that they paid too much for it. And considering their financial situation, they want to dump it. From a Cricket Australia perspective, they're saying, well, you've got a contract, and you're going to honour the contract. And that's why the legals have become involved. I'm not sure of Channel 7's view on why they want to get rid of the Big Bash, saying that it's because, the Australian players aren't going to play. So we've told you before, it's devaluing the product because they're not available and we want the best players playing. The Big Bash has always been like that. Rarely have the Australian players been available on a consistent basis. This is probably going to be a bit more of the case than previous years for obvious reasons. But I think it's convenient for 7 to try and dump it under those circumstances. But I think it's a shame because I think, 7's done a good job of the cricket. I don't know what happens if they don't do it. It would appear that it'll all go behind the plate, all go behind the paywall, except for potentially a couple of test matches. Maybe the Boxing Day test and the New Year's test, I'm not sure. But, I think it now is serious. I thought initially it was just a bit of posturing to maybe get a discount, but it might be a bit more serious than that.
Well, one of the interesting arguments, Whitey and Half, is around the Big Bash. And they're Channel 7 talking about, well, there's never the best players of best Australian players available. There was a little stat over the weekend. I think Steve Smith, out of all those, you know, mainstream Australian players, has played the most Big Bash games over, I think, the previous three or four seasons. That's only at around 20 games he's played. Then, you know, Warner's only played 12 games. Mitch Stark's only played 10 games. So, you know, that Channel 7 are saying, well, the product that we need to produce is not producing the best players with one of the highest, I guess, grossing parts of that contract in the Big Bash. Now, Cricket Australia are arguing back that the Big Bash doesn't rely on those big name players. That's what they're saying. So it's very interesting where all this argument's going and what Channel 7 are doing, because if Channel 7 don't want the cricket rights, will they bid again for them? Does it become an open tender?
Well, I'm not sure who would want it. I think Big Bash will just become a Fox product, which it was, ironically, before the Big Bash started. Or at the first, you know, at the very start of that. So, where we've lost complete sight of all of this is it's pretty simple. That Channel 9 had the international cricket, and a new person came along, or a new partner came along with Channel 10, and they did it differently. And they did it differently because of who was in the commentary box. Ricky Ponting did the cricket. He hadn't done the cricket before. And he was the sort of the linchpin around different commentary. David Barham did it differently, and it was extremely different to the way Channel 9 did, and people gravitated towards that. But it was almost the commentary team were the stars as opposed to the cricketers, and it became this massive thing because it was different, and people liked different. Whereas what's happened now is that it's the same, you know, Channel 7 doing the international cricket, they do the Big Bash, Fox obviously do the international cricket and do the Big Bash. So there's no real difference to the way it's done. And we get a lot of Ricky Ponting during the day, and then we also get Ricky Ponting at night. So that's, one of the key reasons behind it. Because Ponting and particularly, and Channel 10 just did it differently. And it was fresh, and people liked it. And I think there was a bit of an anti-Channel 9 sentiment going on at the time with the way that they'd done it, because they'd done it for so long. And I think that was one of the key reasons for its success.
It's certainly going to be a talking point leading into the summer. What's going to happen with that? Papers have been filed from Channel 7's perspective. Cricket Australia believe they've got a case and they've got an ironclad contract. It's going to be an ugly fight, you would think, for the next little while.
Channel 10 will go... If that contract's ripped up, Channel 10 will go for it. They're owned by CBS. CBS have got squillions of dollars in the US.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know about that. I don't think 10 or 9 want it.
We will see. Let's get to John on the road, who's been waiting for a little while on the open line. Thank you, John, for holding. Good morning.
Good morning, fellas. How are you?
Going all right, thanks.
Just a couple of points. Dylan Robinson, I've seen he's been emergency. Is he going to play this year, do you think? And I want to speak to Rama. And this is like years ago, Rama, when you had cancer and you come back, mate. That just shows enormous... You know, us supporters, we love that kind of thing, but the Bombers are just lacking everything, aren't they? And they really need the president to stand up and say something. Like the Melbourne president said, let's stop mucking around, get rid of some of this dead wood. I just don't understand Worsfold. I just that interview what he was saying. It's just garbage. Absolute garbage.
So firstly,
stand by here, half.
Remy's
about to make some headlines here, half. I think we just sat back and not say anything for five minutes.
We'll get the headlines shortly. What about Dylan Robinson? Do we know what his go is? Because he played the first game of the season and haven't seen him since.
I think they're pretty settled with their defensive sort of unit that they've used this year, St Kilda. So I don't think it's been any more than that he just hasn't been able to get a game.
Yep, okay. Well, and then what about the Bombers, Rama? What are your thoughts on the Bombers?
I actually thought the first quarter and the last quarter for the Bombers was okay on the weekend. Again, you know, we keep going back to it. You look at personnel, they were just obviously wasn't there. And, you know, then they got, I guess, beat up in those middle two quarters, particularly that second quarter. Port Adelaide were too good for them. So, yeah, you know, John's comments after the game were probably a touch confusing. But I do want to say this. John Worsfold has done a pretty good job with Essendon from when he took over. And it's the right time. And he's admitted that himself, that it's the right time for somebody else to take over now. And that's going to be Ben Rutten next season.
Flat out, I agree with that, Rama. We do this a lot in sport. And I don't think it's quite the way it should be done, but it is initially. And then we may sometimes fall back into, we fall for the recency bias and the recency conversations rather than the overall body of work. And to come in and get that place back on track after the most amazing scenario you could possibly imagine, I think he absolutely earns great kudos and respect for. Now, it hasn't gone well in the last little while, and the handover seemingly much more messy than they would have forecast. There's no doubt about that. And the results on field have been ultra disappointing. And no one could argue about that. But I think we should, and when we talk about Essendon and the legacy that John Worsfold leaves, we should understand what he was able to do and what he had to do to bring that place back together, considering the fallout from that that drug saga.
Yep, no doubt. And I totally agree with that. He was a calming influence in that place where, you know, after obviously the supplement stuff that happened, the place was a mess, and he was able to bring some process and procedure back into Essendon, and you know, now he's done that. I think he leaves a really important legacy. It's at the football club. It's probably not one that will be acknowledged too often, I imagine, but I think for the people that know what went down, that legacy will be lasting.
And John Worsfold wasn't at the football club when it all went pear-shaped.
Nope.
And I think that there's no doubt that the dream ticket of James Hird and Mark Thompson evoked a lot of emotion in a lot of Essendon people, and it was successful until it all went pear-shaped because they were winning games of football, they were playing a brand that the Essendon fans enjoyed, and things were going very well. But the reality is that's a long time ago now. But I think, Harf and Rama, one of the big problems with a lot of Essendon fans at the moment, apart from the fact that they haven't won a final in 16 years, is I genuinely think there's a bit of panic. I think there's a bit of panic about how they're playing now, and that's what they're going to play like into the future because of the handover taking place. I think every Essendon fan believes that this is Ben Rutten's game plan. This is the way Ben Rutten wants Essendon to play. This is Ben Rutten's team. And that's the challenge now for Essendon because the fans are worried that, is this what it's going to be? You know, because there were a lot of fans that were off John, whether Essendon likes it or not, with the way that Essendon played the game. And now they've had a year of Ben Rutten and they're going, oh, I'm not sure I like this either. Is this what we've got for the next period of time? So when you couple that with some of Worsfold's comments, which seem to contradict a lot of what he has said previously, and I don't think Essendon fans like the fact that that Worsfold told them to be patient. They're like, hang on a sec, haven't we been patient enough? It's just evoked a lot of emotion in Essendon fans. So that's my best take on why there's a bit of angst around at the moment.
Essendon fans don't like missing the final. They and I've said this before, when I first went to Essendon, it was Essendon play finals, and that was, you know, that was the minimum, almost like the minimum requirement when walking in the door. That was how you were taught that a failure of a season is not to play finals, as simple as that. So you know, I get fans are impatient. All fans are impatient when it's been pretty bare for the last 15 years, obviously. But there have been circumstances in there. You know, Whitey mentioned the combination of James Hird and Bomber Thompson. That was looking like it was obviously working, and then, you know, that just exploded in everybody's faces really, really, really quickly. So, you know, I'm disappointed that Essendon don't play finals again, but at the same time, I'm excited to see what the future can bring and what Ben Rutten can do with a clean run at it now.
Yeah, and they're played by the best team in footy at the moment, or the top of the ladder team in footy.
They're never going to win on Saturday night.
They're not going to win that game, that's right. So we don't read too much into that. The season's over. You've got all those things, complicating factors at the moment for the Bombers. I wouldn't read too much into that. Craig Gabriel flies the globe and he has a lot of friends who are very, very famous. I wouldn't mind betting that he likes the Norwegian music scene and he'd be mates with our man Morty. Craig, good morning.
Norwegian pop, it's called.
I'm sure that's probably right. And your man Mort is having a birthday today.
Yep.
Do you know how old your mate is, Morto?
Yeah, we've got to keep remembering that because of time differences, we're a day ahead.
Yeah.
So he still hasn't had his birthday.
No, that's true, but you've got to work with what we're in. We're in the time zone of Australia,
sure.
So.
Right at this moment, he's still 59, but he'll become 60 tomorrow.
Well, I'm disappointed that your mate Morto, he'll be disappointed more than anything, Craig, because, of course, he's 60 at the moment. He'll be 61 tomorrow, his
61,
time.
Yes. What am I thinking, of course.
Yeah, that's your first error.
He was born in 1959. Math has never been my strong subject.
That's your first error with us on the birthday bulletin, but Norwich Pop will be celebrating.
But did you know who some of his influences were?
Some of his what?
The people that sort of influenced him, his music.
Oh, right. No, who were they?
Well, it took me by surprise when last week, well, 2 weeks ago we were chatting, and he was saying that David Bowie and Simon and Garfunkel. So talk about
contrast.
A difference in genres. I mean, and even Jimi Hendrix, he was telling me. But the one that shocked me was when he said, that he really liked Johnny Cash as well.
Well, that is contrasting influences in M.N. Morto's musical career. But he'll be still celebrating about that big hit in 1985. And great stuff that you keep in contact with him too. Craig, it's good stuff. You're a nice man. Now, what's happening at Flushing Meadow, the US Open Men's Final? There's been an early break. German.
Sasha Zverev got that early break. He's now up 4-2 in this first set. Domi's been looking a bit nervy in the early stages of this. He's still trying to get a bit of a groove with his game. And I think so much of that has really got to do with the fact that he, for the very first time, he is the favorite for the title. And, you know, he's coming to terms with that. And I think he's also trying to push things a little bit too much at the moment. Whereas Zverev is certainly looking way more relaxed. He's powering things. And Zverev's, I think, his mental side, the mental side of his game is he's telling himself, got to get off to a better start than he did in the semis. If you remember, he was down 2-0 before he staged that comeback to beat Pablo Carreño Busta.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a blow-up because, as you say, he is favourite Dominic Thiem, and he's been the one that has been really stable through the tournament, whereas Zverev, as we know, can be quite emotional. And that semi-final performance on the weekend was unbelievably dramatic.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And this is what I've said often. You know, you get to these sort of matches, this round, these tournaments, the majors, anything can happen. It just depends, because it is such a big pressure moment, and it's like a pressure cooker. Can you imagine what it'd be like if there were people in the stands or a crowd in the stands? It does affect players in a different way. And you think that maybe the team should be a little bit more relaxed, because this is the fourth time he's playing the final of a major. And the last time being at this year's Australian Open when he lost to Novak Djokovic in that nail biter. It depends on how it affects a player on the day with these tournaments. They're so different to anything else.
Craig, can we go back to yesterday's women's final? I thought that was just a terrific match. Obviously, Naomi Osaka got over the top in the end, but just a high quality encounter.
Oh, it was a superb match. Not one of the greatest matches, but it was an enthralling match. You know, it really kept your attention. It was exciting. There was so much going on. And the way Vika started that match, you could see a similar situation. You'd say Naomi Osaka was nervous, and in fact, she even admitted it, that she was nervous in the early part. And she said that she had to do something because she didn't want to lose 6-1, 6-love to Vika Azarenka in the final. So she was a point away from being down 1-3, love 3, turned it around. Vika should have held serve in that third game, didn't, gave Naomi the opening. And, she rallied back and provided us with a very entertaining final. Both of them played wonderfully well, and it was fitting of the final at a major.
Well, it had Whitey, had theatre, and that's where the disappointment of no crowds being there, because it was a real match that, because of the theatre of the game, it needed the crowd. It needed the crowd's involvement in that game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, it would have been wonderful to see that, because things were so close, and you know, the crowd would have been getting on Naomi's side when she was trailing, and then Vika, they would have swung across to Vika when she was struggling in that final set and stuff like that. So it would have been wonderful to have had a full house for that match, because it would have just gone up another level, I think, even to what it was.
Let's get to the world of cycling now. Phil Rockner is covering the Tour de France for us. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Now, been a bit happening in the Tour across the weekend. The biggest story, I suppose, outside of the stage wins and all that sort of stuff, is the situation with Romain Bardet. Can you tell us a bit more about what's happened with him, please?
Yeah, this is an issue that's just been boiling away in the background at the moment. But Romain Bardet crashed a couple of stages ago and got up on his bike again and completed the stage. He did so with a concussion, and obviously the concerns around the safety of him and the safety of those he's riding with was pretty evident. He's known to have hemorrhaged during the course of that stage. What it leads to, though, Harf, is the fact that we've got some really clear questions as to the medical defence of why he was back on his bike, and also just the duty of care that the medical staff give. It's inherent in every professional cyclist to finish a stage. It's just in their DNA. They get up, they fall, they crash, they get up, and they try and get back on their bike. They're finished with broken shoulders, broken arms, broken everything, but broken heads is a different thing, and I think this needs to be addressed by the ASO as to how they combat this.
Well, I imagine with concussion being such a hot topic in all sports across the globe, Phil, that this will be certainly a top of the agenda, you would hope, for those running cycling across the globe, because that is a fascinating situation where he's had a small hemorrhage. I mean, that is so dangerous in that area of your body, around the brain. That is not good for business at all. So we hope he's okay, but they can sharpen up some protocols there, I think, in the world of cycling. Speaking of defences, Egan Bernal's defence is crumbling.
Gone.
Just done.
Just done. He lost 8 minutes last night, and he's done. He's Tour de France, he's finished. Good of a few of the people that start piling onto the off team as well. Brad Wiggins has overnight said that they've picked the wrong team to take to France. They didn't bring Chris Froome. They didn't bring Geraint Thomas. I think the logical choice was to bring the guy who won the race the previous year, Egan Bernal, and, you know, he's just off form. This year's a really weird year, as we know. Trying to get the lead-out races and the training done with the right people in place, et cetera, because people are not where they could be due to COVID. He had no power yesterday. He lost time early, and this is the first year, for many years, that the Ineos team or the Sky team before them are nowhere near the top end. He's sitting in 13th place. He's done. But there's no one in his team who can take that over. There's no one who can back him up. They are all in on Egan Bernal, and he's now done. He may have a return to form. There may be a bright spot. There could be a stage win. But the big hitters at the moment are not concerned with what he's got to offer.
So when you look at the fact that there are all these cases, the COVID cases rising in France, I know they put extra protocols on to make sure that people weren't sort of at the start and finish of the stages. What's it like, particularly going up the mountains, when we're used to seeing so many people just crowding the riders as they get to the peak of the climb?
Yeah, we talked about this a couple of days ago, didn't we? It's odd. Last night they finished, basically they shut the mountain. There was no one on top of the mountain because of the spike in COVID cases in that region. And it must be so risky. It's not the fact that they're playing at one stadium like in the AFL where they've got a couple of stadiums in rotation. These guys are moving around a country that is getting thousands of cases reported every single day. It's just on a knife's edge. And, you know, to be fair, I miss a guy running next to a rider with a long green mankini. I miss the flares. I miss a bunch of dudes with Viking hats on who have clearly been at it all day and have had too many. I miss that sort of chaos. It doesn't feel like the Tour de France. As long as I've been watching it since 1987, those mountain passes have been occupied by lunatics. And we miss that element of the tour. It really is quiet up there. It's quite ghostly when they go up to the mountains and there's just no one there. It could be a training ride. You know, the last, second to last stage, guys, is a time trial up a mountain, which I think they're calling for it to be empty. It really is a weird Tour de France. And the fact that it's still running, I think, is a minor miracle.
Jimmy Bartel, and all I can see at the moment is his feet. Jim, good morning.
Morning. I've got to spin the camera around here. I was
caught watching a bit of
the NFL. NFL's back, and I do enjoy watching that. So that's on. But I just all I ask for half is just 5% from you, if that's okay.
5% of again?
When the form ladder gets sold for its licensing rights, because you look like a genius. You've been selling Melbourne all year to make the finals into eighth spot.
Yep.
And that could quite well happen.
It's not over yet, Jim. You're telling me there's a chance. There's a chance.
I just want 5% when, you know, the endorsements come in, you sell the licensing to Google, Apple, you name it. It's going to be on everyone's phone, Android and Apple. The Daniel Harford form ladder. It'll be the most downloaded app next football season.
Well, don't say I didn't warn you about the form ladder. And I'm almost most proud of Adelaide being winners. Form ladder, yes, predicted this. Yeah. What I'm almost most proud of for the form ladder. But, yeah, we're alive, Jim. We're alive. And I did receive a call from some guy from Silicon Valley yesterday. Didn't answer. It was just an odd number to be ringing. I might take that call next time.
Yeah, Zuckerberg, you name it, all these sort of guys. But I just love the pride. I see you, obviously, during the weekend with other football commitments, and you've got your chest so far puffed out, it's the size of Shane Mumford's chest.
Well, Mummy had the chest out a bit on the weekend, too, for the Giants. Let's start there, Jim. Let's start at the Giants and the D's. Well, it's one of the form ladder games as well, of course, with the D's, so it's an important reference point for us because they are still alive, the D's, in season 2020, despite the fact they've done everything possible by themselves to not be there. They are still alive. They're sitting just outside the eight at the moment, but have an opportunity with the Round 18 performance. It's a fascinating tale, this one, Jim. It was a massive game coming in, and your club left out their captain, your captain, as part of an eight change opportunity for the Giants on Saturday night against the D's, which was there's a lot to change in any one time, Jimmy. Season's on the line and eight changes. Is that unusual, let alone the captain being dropped?
Eight change. Oh, we'll start with the eight changes first and then we can drill down on the sort of the captaincy sort of stuff. But I think people forgot those changes that come in were a lot of players who actually played the majority of the season. So Kelly, Perryman, these sort of guys, Daniels. All these guys would have been picked anyway. So if it's round 3, round 13, you name it, they would have been picked because they're available. So, and they make the side better. And that they're out for either being managed or, in Kelly's case, you know, he was coming back from the concussion. So I think people forgot to look at some of those ins were important ins and you had to pick them.
Yeah.
I think Leon, just on the performance, Leon, I think he just nailed it, and I was watching the game. The fundamentals just hurt them again. It sounds so basic and simple, and we talk about it a lot, nearly every Monday, about sides, how they get beaten. You can, I almost sound like Gary Ayres here. You can do the X's and the O's and things like that, but it's the fundamentals that hurt you the most, especially in big games. And you go through it, and it's not blaming individuals, but yet you have a drop mark that you should take, turns into a goal. You fumble the ball twice on your own half forward line. You get opened up. That's a goal. You've got the outnumber defending in the goal square, but you spoil it back into the corridor when you should either punch it wide to the boundary or clear it to the point post. Goal. You're on the boundary line getting tackled. Just take the ball over. Don't try and get an extra stat out on the full. Goal. You know what I mean? So it's just like fundamentals and decision making. So that's nothing to do with, you know, people going, oh, where's the game plan? Where's the game plan? If you're giving up four goals where literally a coach can't do anything but going, oh, I can't actually fix that while the game's happening.
No, well, errors, skill errors and decision errors you can't coach. I mean, they're the things that, during a game, they're the things that just happen, and you're just hoping like hell that they don't affect you significantly to a point where the results are hinged on those outcomes. So that's, I don't think any rational football fan would be sitting there going, well, if the bloody coach is fine, he can't coach, there's too many mistakes. That's, I think most people would assist that. And in the end, they made a few mistakes, as did Melbourne along the way, but they both played. What I liked about the Giants and Melbourne game, boys, is the fact that both teams took the game on. They were more aggressive with the way they wanted to play, and we saw a really positive game on the back of it. But why does it take to that point, Jim, in the season when it's all on the line and second last round of the home and away for us to see that from either team, not just the Giants, but Melbourne as well?
Well, I think Melbourne's trying to be play like this in the last few weeks. And, we talked about goal kickers. When I see Oscar Baker and Trent Rivers, who are wing, even Rivers goes back to half back, inside your forward 50, and this is what we've been talking about, taking the territory and defending high, when they're kicking goals, both of them kick two each, it's that aggressiveness that I like in the way Melbourne plays. It's get high in defence, try and turn the footy over high, and then you can get some scoreboard impact. It's not waiting all the way back until, even though he's been absolutely brilliant, Stephen May to win it back for you, you know, deep in defence. I'd like that aggressiveness, and it seems like they've almost started to bottle a bit of a Christian Petrarca's energy. They seem excited. They seem they're trying to outnumber. They're trying to move the ball a lot more, quicker and forward. And I think that's been our complaint, hasn't it, Ramo, when Melbourne are playing poor? Yeah, they can win a truckload of the footy, contested and all that, but they actually go nowhere with it. Or the final bloke who gets it is under pressure. Now, I think they're trying and starting to get a little bit more of, you know, Oliver wins it and the ball is released to someone in a bit of space. Or the next person's got at least can, you know, square the shoulders and kick the ball inside forward 50. So, look, they're not perfect, but they've certainly come a long way than where they were in the middle of the season.
Yeah, and it's starting to go forward with the ball, which you love seeing. Otherwise, you become easy to defend. Teams just sit back and just wait till you start to come forward. But that team's already set up with the unpredictability of actually going forward, and I can't believe I'm saying unpredictability with going forward, because that should be normal from when you're dominating clearance and contested possessions. You should come forward quickly from that position. But in the past, Melbourne have tended, like you say, Jim, to go sideways, backwards, inside, outside, and, you know, by the time they get the ball forward, there's too many numbers there. So I just want to go back to those fundamentals that you talk about. They're hard to coach, obviously, during a game, but they're easy to teach during the week.
Correct.
And I think that's something that our game, and I'm just not just talking about the Giants here, I'm talking about AFL in general. We've probably gone away from that. And I know, Half, you're big on this, on those little fundamentals. You can have any game plan you want. You can have the best game plan you want, but if you can't execute the basics in a pressure situation, you're going to lose. Simple as that.
The big finals, and I've seen this has hurt Geelong in finals in the past and other teams, you watch the first quarter and the team that fumbles or makes those, as we say, the routine fundamental errors in the first quarter, they just get beaten. Because now with the way teams play defence, and we all sort of point out how quick and how well they get set up, if you fumble the ball or even fumble it twice, the numbers that just come on top of you, your teammates who were in a good position and they're in a bad position, it's just the knock-on effect from the most basic things. And it's no coincidence all the great sides, not only in football, but any sport, you hear them and you hear their coaches and players talk about it. Oh, we just do the fundamentals. It's the boring stuff. I know it's cliche and everyone goes, oh, boring, give us something. Give us the magic sauce why the Melbourne Storm are so good. And they go, we just complete our sets. You hear, you know, New England Patriots, Whitey, Belichick and all that, become a master in your position. That's all I need to do is my role, do it better than anyone else. The San Antonio Spurs, who played 20-plus years of playoffs, their number one player of all time was called the Big Fundamental in Tim Duncan. It was just do the basics well and repeat.
Okay, I've got to ask, your season's on the line and you drop the captain, who's just signed a 7-year contract at the start of this year. It doesn't look good from the outside. It looks like there's something not right for that to happen, because Stephen Cornelio over the years at the Giants has often been the one that gets the job done for his team in a close finish particularly. I'm not going to just put this at you, Jimmy, because obviously you're slightly restricted in what you can say as a board member of the Giants, but it's a more open question. Why would you do it?
Well, okay, keeping it open and broad, why wasn't last week a must-win game? Like the week before?
Well, because it's got really serious for the Giants to make the finals. You win the last two, you play.
So that's the problem. That's the problem you can get into as a football club. You value games differently. So you shouldn't value performance differently. And that you shouldn't hold different players to different levels. And the fact that he's got a seven-year contract or a one-year contract shouldn't be the way you judge performance either. And that's where you can fall into real issues as a club. Like, if, not talking about Steve Cornelio, but if, using myself for example, if I'm allowed a free pass, we say in my, say I'm 10 years into my career, and I'm allowed a free pass for not having great performance or up to the standards expected, how does that look for when Joel Selwood comes into the club?
No, I understand that, but how did it get to this point? Should it have got to this point?
Well, it's at the point that it was at because he was out of form, and he admits that. It's just like any other selection. The fact that people are saying, "Oh, he signed a 7-year deal." I don't get why people keep referencing his contract.
Well, it goes to show the importance of him in the the grand scheme of things.
But he's the captain of your club. Who was out of form, and we picked somebody else.
It did, and it.
I think people then, the immediate thing is people go, "Oh, 7-year contract. Oh, he must be on the way out." No, it's nothing sinister.
No,
it's just.
I don't think that's the commentary. I think the commentary is that, regardless of whether he's in form or not, he's still in your best 22. And
yeah, when he's playing in form, yeah.
I would have thought that there would be, that he would
that's
have been
like
more useful for. Yeah, but he would have been more useful for you in a close finish than some of the other players that were picked on the weekend, even if he was playing in a different position or whatever the case may be. Or maybe it should have been done 4 or 6 weeks ago when it nearly did get done. But it is a strange one, Jimmy, when you have got your captain. And the reference of the 7-year deal is just the value that they place on him as a footballer. Yeah. That when the season is on the line, that he's not selected. That's red lights and sirens wailing to the football team where it is compared to where it should be.
Yeah, correct. But that's probably where we're at as a club, where we should be and where we are at poles apart at the moment. But I think you articulated it well there, Whitey. I understand, to use your term, red sirens and flags when you articulate it like that. But there's been people who go, "Oh, 7-year deal, you've dropped him, he's got to be out now." But he had opportunities. No. And maybe you probably said the right thing. It probably could have happened a couple of weeks ago, but Leon tried him at half forward the week before, tried him in a number of different spots. You just can't. You've got to get picked on the standards and performance, and Cogs admitted he wasn't up to it.
There's no doubt it's a story, though, Jimmy. It's the first time in 26 years that it's happened, that a captain's been dropped. You're always going to get conversation about it, and the season was on the line. So these are when traditionally, your leaders are the ones that you lean on, and you couldn't lean on your captain on the weekend because he wasn't there. So that's why it's a conversation starter. Now you're out of the finals, effectively.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It's a good point. It's a good point that you make about it's when your leaders stand up. And I think if you look through the Giants this year, collectively, not just Stephen Cornelio, but a lot of the Giants leaders haven't stood up. And the teams that are in the top four at the moment, in a very weird season, have collectively stood up. You think of when Richmond's players have been out, they have, their leaders have stood up. We saw and commented about the performance of West Coast with all those players out last week against St Kilda. Their leaders stood up. The Giants' leaders, too often during the course of the year, haven't stood up. And Jeremy Cameron is another one of those.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah. It's season end, effectively, for the Giants. And coming off a grand final, so there's a lot of talking coming about your football club in the next little while, Jim, because
and
of
it's deserved.
Like, a failed year.
Yeah, and I hope I haven't come across as too defensive and things like that, but it's 100% deserved what you guys are saying. Like, I always use, and it's not because you guys know, my relationship with Ken Hinckley going all the way back to the great Bell Park Footy Club, but these lines are always perfect in football. You get what you deserve. And the Giants at the moment are getting that.
Our personnel will probably change a little bit over the next few weeks, if we're good enough to keep going for a few weeks. But I wouldn't be hanging... we won't be hanging our hat on that, saying, we'll just get a few players back and everything will be fine. Well, Joel's played a lot of the year and he's been a really good player for us, and Gary's a star, so... you always ask those questions, like how important is cohesion versus really, really good players. I think retrospectively you'll be able to go back and say, oh, well, you didn't play very well because you lost your cohesion because you brought those guys in. That may or may not be true, but I think our forecasting suggests that we'd be a better team with them in it.
That would seem to make sense. It's Chris Scott talking about the inclusions eventually of Joel Selwood and Gary Ablett into a team that were defeated by 26 points on Friday night to the Tigers. They kept them to one goal to three-quarter time. The Parole Cats could not find a way through. The juggernaut of the Tigers just said, seriously, we just play around until there's something on the line. And when there's something on the line, we're just going to show you how good we are. And they did that. On Friday night, Ramo, what did we learn on Friday night? Jimmy Bartel with us, our Monday specialist as well. Yeah. Ramo, what did we learn?
We learned that when Geelong play slow and against the better teams, they simply can't score. They don't know how to... When they're playing slow, Geelong, they don't know how to take the ball. Again, this is a conversation we had just earlier with Melbourne. They don't know how to take the ball forward into a scoring position. What Geelong were afraid of on Friday night was playing quick and turning the ball over. But if they played quick, they would have got the ball deeper into their forward half, and a turnover is not that much of a problem. But playing slow, just that allowed Richmond just to wait and sweat and wait and sweat. And then when Richmond went and got the ball and won the ball back, they went quick. And that caught Geelong on the hop. The only Geelong defender that could handle it on Friday night was Tom Stewart. He was terrific. But other than that, no other Geelong defender could really handle how quick the ball was coming in. The Tigers, they're a smart team, but I think there's a little bit of a side story to all this as well. Obviously, what happened with Richmond a couple of weeks ago with Sydney Stack and Coleman Jones, that can go two ways. It can obviously be a disastrous effect or have a galvanising effect. I think it's clearly had a galvanising effect. Dimmer's gone the line of, well, it's us against them. We've got our, we've got our massive membership. We've got 100,000 supporters, and everyone else is against us. And I think that works for some playing groups, and clearly it's working for Richmond. Dylan Grimes was terrific, but I feel like out of that game, obviously impressed with Richmond, but more disappointed for Geelong. I thought it was a chance for them to make probably more of a statement rather than Richmond winning that game.
Jim, how did you see it all unfolding watching that game? Because it was contrasting styles. We talked about it going into the game, two very contrasting styles of football and how they want to play the game and move the ball and defend the contest. How did you see it?
Yeah, I still saw it as this is going to be the grand final matchup. I still think this is the two best sides in it. And again, we say this every time Geelong loses. It's speed of ball movement. It's getting caught in the back half, as Ramo touched on it. Because when they do that, Geelong, it means Hawkins has to become a little bit more stationary. I know he's not like an explosive leader like other key forwards, but he does those short leads, he gets the body position. But what it allows Richmond to do is, it's almost using basketball sort of analogy or tactics when the likes of Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan were playing, is the opposition says they're going to have 40 points. We don't want to get beaten with what we know. So you just swamp that one player. So you saw Grimes, Vlosten, obviously Bolter with his matchup, all the others is going, well, we've slowed Geelong up and they've gone really slow. The only option here forward is Hawkins. Now, I know Radaglia jumped up and kicked a couple of goals late, but if you're even an opposition defence, like I know when Carlton, when you used to play against Favola when he was dominant, it's like you'd almost say to Carlton, well, if we just stop Favola, we'll try and force somebody else to kick five goals. Who, and you know, who's probably either doesn't quite have that capability or it'll find it difficult.
So the one that they really missed on Friday night, Geelong, was Gary Rowan. He was the late withdrawal. He just adds that extra element to their forward line. So Hawkins kicked 40 goals for the season. Then Rowan 19, Myers 16, and then you're starting to get into the midfielders. Then Menengola 13, Mitch Duncan 12. So, you know, without Gary Rowan, Jim's exactly right. It was almost like Tom Hawkins or bust until Radaglia went down there in the last quarter, Whitey.
What I don't understand, this is, you guys played the game, but a lot of people would have been seeing there going on Friday night. Why, Geelong, would you do what you did in the second half of last year's preliminary final when it didn't work going slow?
Couldn't agree with you more.
So they end up doing exactly what they did in the second half when they know that doesn't work. So that's easy to say that on the couch. But are we not giving enough credit to Richmond because they made Geelong go so slow? Or was it that just Geelong decided that they would go slow?
No, I'm giving all the credit to Richmond. Like it might have sounded like I was just focusing on the Cats. I thought Richmond was super. That's as, their form in the last few weeks. You go to the West Coast game. Now, the Freo game, they just did what they had to do. Like, they played sort of the first 5 minutes of each game against Freo. But, no, I thought that was a powerful display from Richmond. It was that unified, we talked about that word cohesion. It was that unified cohesion from the half-back line. They all knew their role. They intercepted and then they went quick. You know, like Castagna and these sort of guys, they just got on their bike. And that's where Geelong in big finals in recent years has been beaten. They get, because they go slow and they're back deeper, but they get really flat in their defensive line. So as soon as you break the first line, you've got to beat Tom Stewart. So it becomes almost like a schoolyard game. You've got to beat Tom Stewart in the British Bulldog. You just got to beat him back, and they've got that speed to do that, Richmond.
But this is the thing, they just sat, that Richmond sat there and waited. Whitey. Geelong took 111 marks in that game on Friday night to 73 only. But then you look at the intercept possessions, it was 55 to Geelong, 67 to Richmond. So they just waited and waited and waited, sweated on Geelong, making a mistake with that slow ball movement, then they went quick.
So what happens if they meet again? How would it play out?
Yeah, well, Geelong have to be... You have to be willing to take a risk. So as soon as you... Anytime you mark the ball... Now, I get there's times when you're deep in your defence, you have to bring it out cautiously. But I'm talking about when you get sort of from your back 50 arc towards the Toyota logos, you got to go a bit quicker there, whether that's by short handball or the overlapping handball, that short kick on the 45. But probably the question I got for you guys is, we've probably got Gary and Selwood coming back in. But does Radaglia and Stanley both play? Rowan comes back in. So who misses? Like, Chris Scott touched on it there half with the play on. Who misses? Like, you'd obviously think young Jarvis would miss coming into the finals. Yep. Close enough.
Yeah. To out
for maybe Ablett. But the question comes for Radaglia and Stanley. Do they play both? Because, or they play one, Blitzarves goes back, and because Jack Riewoldt was fantastic, and you'd normally think, well, Blitzarves would slide across to Riewoldt.
I've never understood why you take Blitzarves out of defence. I think you're taking away one of your great strengths. The way he plays as a centre half back, I do sort of get why you take him up into the ruck, because he plays as another on baller. But I think the combination of Blitzarves and Stewart works perfectly, because they're both, you know, both intercept markers. Radaglia Stanley ones in it. So Radaglia around the ground is probably a better contested mark than Stanley. The aggression side, I think, probably falls to Radaglia as well. I like Radaglia in the ruck, but I've always felt when Radaglia and Hawkins play forward together, they do get in each other's way a little bit because Radaglia likes to be the deepest forward as well. So that's a bit of a concern there. But when the question was when they play again next time, Whitey, if they play, if you look at the way Port Adelaide play, we all thought that game was an unbelievable game. But what Port Adelaide did that day is they were prepared to make a mistake. They were prepared to turn the ball over to score. And by doing that, they kept the speed on the game in its entirety. So they were trying to catch Richmond out constantly. And when you play against the Tigers, and we've spoken this a lot on a Friday about Richmond when we preview games, you've got to separate their defenders.
Yep.
The only way you can separate defenders is if you move the ball quickly. If you're slow ball movement, that's when Grimes and Vlosten and Bolter and even Liam Baker's 5 foot tall, but he gets in the way. He comes in, you know, second and third man across in contest, and they help out. So when Port Adelaide beat Richmond, it was constantly going into a forward line that was separated.
Yeah, but this is the whole thing, isn't it? Sort of crystallising in my mind a little bit that to beat Richmond in big games, which is to beat Richmond in finals, you've got to be risky. And so many teams are so risk-averse that it plays into Richmond's hands. And they've got this magic potion or this game plan that means that if you're going to beat us, you've got to take risks. And because if you don't, we're going to gobble you up.
But if everyone's on the same page, it's not actually risky. It's predictable. So if everyone's on the same page that at this point on the ground, we're going to play on or we're going to create the overlap or we're going to try and get the 45... You can actually take those risks and make mistakes, but you've got the outnumber because everyone is on the same page. Does that make sense? So it might still seem like a risky option. And you have a look at the way some sides, like when West Coast, they're a beautiful kicking side when they won the flag, and they take those switch kicks and things like that, and some people might go, yeah, that's a bit risky, but it was so predictable. So if there was a mistake anyway, they had the outnumber which could butter it up.
They were very good, Richmond. I think you said before is right, Jim. It's more about Richmond, I think, than Geelong, I reckon, from Friday night. And Geelong will learn a fair bit about it, I think, should they meet again in post-season activity. But it was more about Richmond. They were brilliant.
Were you happy? Jack Riewoldt. I was smiling watching his game. Like, I've seen a few of his games this year where he hasn't had big numbers, but I could just see it's just so close. Like, he was in the right position. He was... You know, getting hands on balls. He probably just wasn't getting the goal, but he was setting up teammates. It was good for him to have a good night, I thought.
Yeah, he's been good for about a month now. He looks a lot fresher. So I'm going to ask the three of you, based on what you saw on Friday night, there's only two teams, if the two of them met in a preliminary final... If the two of them met in a preliminary final, based on what you saw last night, Friday night, who's going to win? Like, because I think all of us on Friday, I know Jimmy wasn't part of Friday, we all tipped Geelong, but based on what we saw, who would win? Or who'd you be confident about winning? Both teams have got players to come back.
Richmond. That's the known factor, the experience factor, what they've done. And they have a gear for big games that not many other teams have.
No,
it's hard to argue with that, Huff.
What do you reckon, Rama?
I'm still confident in Geelong. I think they learned a valuable lesson. You get Richmond late in the season, which they did on Friday night. It's got to be clear now. What they've tried to do is failed twice now in big games, in a prelim final and then on Friday night. That slow movement won't work against Richmond. They can't beat them if they play that style. So they'll change it. They're smart enough and experienced enough team to change it.
Yeah, no, I think we'll be back in the Tigers at the moment. No, we don't lose too much confidence in Geelong, but we're just back to the Tigers.
Nah, no way.
Because they're very, very good. Richard and Cowes wants to talk about the Tigers. Hello, Rich.
Good morning, guys. Look, somebody made a comment that if you go quick against Richmond and you split that defence up, that's fine in theory. You're playing on a very tight, narrow ground, and Richmond flew to Adelaide on the morning of the match because of this virus thing, and they got six blokes out and pulled out a full team in.
That was me. Yeah. I didn't think that game that you're talking about against Port Adelaide, I actually didn't think Richmond played well in that game. If you go back and look at the stats, Richmond were resoundingly beaten in a lot of areas, but it was crystal clear in that game. Port Adelaide moved the ball quick, and Richmond didn't like it. They did not like that.
And there's a bit of difference with the way Port Adelaide set up their half-back line to Geelong, just the type of player. Now, Geelong, they're very tall down back. It's been super, and this is not a knock on Geelong's defence. It's just the personnel they've got. They're a kicking-first back line. So, but if you have a look at Port Adelaide's half-backs with Byrne, Jones and the other sort of players they play there, they take the game forward with their feet a bit more. So that they calling it square up, as we said earlier, square the shoulders up. They'll take a bit of distance running first or carrying the football. So that's how you can play a bit quicker. Whereas the Geelong back line, there's no one who really carries it out of the back line.
No.
Stewart's an interceptor.
Stewart's an interceptor and a kick first, good kick. Even Tui, when he was back there, is a kick first. Blitzars is a slower kicking player. Henry is a kicker. Like, he's not a run and take the game on.
Big Harry doesn't do a lot of running and taking it on either, so you're right.
Henderson doesn't. So that's why when young Jordan Clark, when he was in, he was actually a point of difference to that Geelong back line. Now, his own form, he's got to get in the side and injuries and things like that, but he is already a point of difference to that Geelong back line group.
Need to get David Wojcinski back.
Yes, or Zach Williams.
Mackay Cockatoo should be trained as a backman.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.